Okay, everyone, welcome to another episode of Liberty Lands. I am your host, Big John, and as always, being joined today by my friend and partner in this endeavor, Mr. Mike Termott. Mike, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good. It's a pleasure to be with you, as always.
As always, indeed, indeed. Always a pleasure to do these shows. And today we have something interesting, away from our usual economics and things of that nature, but it is an important issue nonetheless. And that is the concept of peace, believe it or not. You know, let's take the positive. Let's not take the negative and say war, Mike. Let's talk about peace. Let's have a positive outlook. One of the things President Trump of late has been very, very much on the PR bandwagon is that he is the greatest peacemaking president of all time.
Yep.
And to the extent that this is a noble pursuit, I certainly applaud him on that.
Yep.
But the question is he truly someone who brokers peace, or is he someone who brokers deals somewhere in between? So, of course, the main thing we want to talk about is the president's role and the general situation between Russia and Ukraine. The war is still ongoing, and the president has set up to say, and I think this was the quote, that he figures if he gets a lasting peace deal between Russia and Ukraine, then he'll be buying a ticket to heaven, which, again, that's another interesting thing I want to talk about. But, Mike, let's start off with that. Let's talk about, like, say, the current state of Russia-Ukraine and the president's efforts to negotiate a peace deal.
Boy, there's a lot to unpack. Holy cow, there's a lot to unpack there. Just let's make a quick review of efforts toward peace around the world. By the way, it is true. All libertarians go to heaven.
Oh, yes, thankfully. Thank you, Mike.
So it is, and I mean that with a lowercase l, of course.
Yeah.
And so we hold out hope for President Trump.
True.
He needs to decentralize power domestically, and I think that he needs to, and his administration needs to get very good at empowering the nations with which he is dealing. In other words, he needs to understand that he needs to set up situations where, in the long term, peace lasts, because it is in the interest of each party, and they are empowered to stick to it. To your insinuation earlier about transactionalism, the president does tend to exaggerate the value of his role, because the deals that he is cutting can be a little bit transactional and not have the long-term effects that we're all looking for. Now, having said that, by the way, you know, let us state what should be the obvious, but in today's contentious world is not. Yes, it is a great thing that the president of the United States, whoever that might be, it is a great thing that the president of the United States is focused on trying to achieve peace around the world as frequently as possible. And if he is going to exaggerate his role, that is a small price to pay to get his nose and shoulder to the grindstone. I think we all agree with that. If, you know, we sometimes complain about the we are going to complain today about the administration's crappy staff work in a couple of places, especially regarding Ukraine, Russia. But it is important for us to bear in mind that if you were to peel the onion back a few years,
right,
if I can mix metaphors, and look at prior GOP administrations, prior Democratic administrations, you would find a whole lot of U.S. presidents who were not that interested in peace. Maybe they said so, but they were more interested in the control of the United States, right? The entire neocon frame of reference is the world is safer when America is stronger.
Right.
Peace through strength. Well, that meant peace for you as long as it's strength for the United States. And you aren't getting your peace unless we get our strength. So that is a frame of reference that I believe is being rejected by this administration, by the American populace in general, by libertarians particularly. I have said for the past couple of years that peace through strength is a misplacement of priority. That the foreign policy of the United States needs to recognize that peace through strength is a cute slogan, but is not only misplaced priority, but doesn't work. It's not true. You do not achieve peace through the exertion of American strength. And that would be a cool thing if it were true, but it's not true. And if you look at examples of American interventionism over the years, I think it's pretty clear that no matter how strong we are and how much strength we project, it is no guarantee for peace anywhere around the world. But I do believe that President Trump recognizes, I don't think he would say it quite the way I'm about to say it, but the true is actually the reverse, that strength is achieved through peace. It is strength through peace, not peace through strength. It is strength through peace, that the world is stronger when we are at peace. And therefore, we want to achieve peace, I don't want to say at any cost, right, no matter what. But the emphasis has to be in achieving peace and thereby allowing nations to build up their economies, their culture, their democracies, their nation state status. That's where the emphasis has to be. And so if Trump's attitude is a little bit transactional, you know, there are plenty of examples where he has at least moved the ball down the field.
Right, right. And that's a good thing for the president, even if it does come off being a bit self-serving.
A lot of President Trump's transactional deals have not instituted long-term peace that we can confidently predict.
Right.
But if you were to look at, you and I were talking about some of these others, I had to take a minute. There are so many. I had to take a minute and make a couple of notes to jot them down, right? So we remember to at least touch on them. If you were to look at Serbia-Kosovo, which is the old deal, right, from the Trump one, here the White House inserted trade incentives to bring those sides together. Now, critics suggested that there was, in effect, economic bribery involved in order to subsume more fundamental long-term problems.
Right.
I think that's a fair criticism. I'm okay with that, right? Mm-hmm. If the big objective is to make people stop shooting at each other, you know, a little bribery can go a long ways. If you were to look at Rwanda, Congo, right, Rwanda, DRC, here the president, this is a more recent deal, very recent,
right.
The president has promised investment. There is criticism regarding whether that investment is going to come through, whether it has come through. That remains to be seen. Okay, I think that that's a fair criticism. I think it's a fair criticism to say that once again, the underlying more fundamental, some would argue downright cultural issues have not been resolved. I get that. I get that. But again, if the goal is to make human beings stop shooting at each other, and we're going to try to paper over a few things with some investment, you'll see where I'm going. That doesn't bother me, right?
Right.
That doesn't bother me. I mean, we're, you know, this is not for Mother Teresa. This is, you know, can't we stop shooting each other and all get rich? Is really the attitude that I like a libertarian president to adopt. And I'm not saying President Trump is a libertarian, but to the extent to which he has a tiny bit of a libertarian streak, we want to foster that.
Right, right,
right. Egypt, speaking of economics, Egypt, this is all about water rights. This is a long-standing dispute that has gone on for many, many years. It's actually a three-way argument, and people remain mad at each other. We do not have a long-term resolution. I understand that. In fact, people have asserted that the White House cut a deal that can't possibly hold because not everyone is down with the deal. Okay, I get that, right? But that goes in the category of has not yet gone as well as we hope. That does not go in the category of White House doesn't care. White Right. House is not committed to trying to resolve the conflict. White House does not have its priorities aligned. No. And so as much as I understand, few people inside the Republican Party criticize the White House as much as I do. But having said that, you've got to applaud some effort here. And again, an economic focus, not a bad thing. India-Pakistan, right? Right. This one, big dispute because the president said that he brokered the deal. India says basically, no, you didn't. That's a problem. The president has backed off of his rhetoric. Well, I played a role, offered trade incentives, yada, yada,
right.
yada.
Right.
If that's our biggest problem, right, we have learned how to weather the president of the United States exaggerating his goodness and light. That's a right. problem that's bigger than just India, Pakistan. It's right. a problem that we are learning how to deal with. That's the least of our problems.
Right. right. Yeah, but Mike, here look, you've made fine points. And for the most part, I agree with you that, you know, if we're trading economic incentives for lives, essentially, fair enough. But I have two questions for you. As any good behavioralist will tell you, there's a difference between bribing and rewarding, right? Bribery is a temporary solution that never works. Reward seeks to implement behavioral changes.
Yes.
You change your behavior, yes. you get a reward. If possible, yes. the reward is immediate and self-sustaining.
Yep.
You continue the good behavior, your rewards remain and possibly increase. So
yes.
my question to you is,
yep.
is the president engaging in bribery, essentially, international bribery, which has its limited, to your point, has its limited benefits, and it prevents yep. people from dying, or is he engaging in the more preferred and longer-lasting reward for good behavior?
In the Ukrainian-Russian example, there are economics at play as well, economic incentives, for example. The Trump administration has already inked a deal. The details may or may not be forthcoming anytime soon.
Right.
But for American firms and potentially, my understanding, the American government to invest in Ukraine in the development of course, what we're calling rare earth minerals. And I think it's important for us to recognize that this is hard, right? There are going right. to be elements of that deal that don't go well. It's enormously expensive. Some companies may pull the plug on their role before you wish that they were. Some mines are going to work out. Some mines are not going to work out. The prices of the commodities are going to swing in various directions that may disappoint you from time to time. And the cost of extraction, the demand for what it is you're extracting, there are so many variables. I have right. no doubt that in the future, people are going to be complaining about that deal. And from a libertarian, from a strictly libertarian perspective, we wish that the American government were not pressuring American companies into doing its bidding.
Right.
We get all of that, right? We understand all of the imperfections.
Right, right.
We understand all of the imperfections. But if you're going to compromise somewhere in order to bring a war to an end, I like the idea of compromising on the separation between government and business.
Right.
I like compromising. Now, let's make that the first thing as a matter of principle that we throw overboard and see if we can create private sector investments for this to go well, so that the Ukrainian government eventually gets pressure from the Ukrainian people
right.
that see a future with some economic light at the end of the tunnel. And I would say the same thing about Russia. Now, I do believe that economic pressure on Russia is a much more difficult thing.
Right.
Russia is much less a democracy than Ukraine is. For all of the imperfections in the Ukrainian democracy, Russian, let me use my fingers, democracy is even worse. That's a whole nother podcast, right?
Right. So before we launch into the Alaska summit, so-called Alaska summit, and then the follow-up in Washington, there is the concept that the president, in a lot of these, and I'll use his rhetoric, in the greatest peacemaking deals of any president in history, there is this strain, it seems, of two elements. One is the bullying aspect. Now, I'm not treading lightly here. You know, I'm not like Mr. Sensitive, but I use bullying in the sense of an economic club that you referred to, right? Like, yeah, we are the world's largest economy by far, and we're going to use that power of the purse, so to speak, to beat you over the head until you do the right thing, right? Yeah. So that's one aspect. You've kind of addressed that. Is it perfect? No, but it's better than people killing each other. So I can at least accept that trade-off if you present it as a trade-off. But the second thing is a little more troubling to me, and specific to Russia, Ukraine, we see it again, which is that the president almost picks sides. He'll say Russia is the major power here, and it's hard to argue that, right? Yep. In India, Pakistan, India was the big player. I'm not going to deal with Pakistan. I'm not going to deal with Ukraine. Famously, he started peace talks and didn't invite Zelensky to the meetings, right?
So, and when he had Zelensky in the White House without Putin, he spent it yelling at Zelensky.
Right. So to the extent that that is also a form of bullying, and it is a form of favoritism, is that an approach? Like, it might be effective in the short term, but does it build a lasting peace? Or are we okay with saying, let's bully Zelensky? Let's force him to give up his nation's sovereignty. It's weird.
Well, it is. Not only is that a good question, I might go so far as to argue that is the question.
Mm.
Look, there are those who would argue that if you are bullying either side, that's a problem. That doesn't bother me.
Mm.
The idea of bullying one side and not both sides, I think, is more problematic because you run the risk of getting a deal that doesn't hold. Remember that the reason we're in this mess is because the Ukrainians were bullied into something in the early 90s that turned out not to be in their interest, because, as it turns out, you can't trust the long-term commitment of superpowers, Russia and the United States,
right,
to what looked like the incentives they had in place when the transaction was engaged in the first place. And so what the Ukrainians had perceived as real ironclad security guarantees weren't, right? Guarantees that the Russians wouldn't invade, guarantees that the Americans would make sure that they wouldn't invade and that they would be punished if they were. None of that really held up as well over time as we had hoped. I think the great lesson of the past 35 years, since the Cold War, right?
Mm.
The great lesson is that superpowers have interests just like anyone else.
Right.
That they pursue their self-interest, that there is an interest in world peace. I don't mean that it's zero, but as Kissinger would say, it's a matter of stability. It's not because we seem to have a greater commitment to world peace than anybody else. We have a greater commitment to world stability because we run an open economy and rely on international trade. That's what this is all about. So if we don't do a lot of trade with you, you know, the incentive for us to make sure that you stay independent is just not quite the same as it used to be.
So Mike, I'm sorry.
We're in a tough spot.
Yeah.
Because of what had been bullying. Now, before you...
Yeah.
You're going to say something really smart. I can almost predict what you're going to say. But let me jump in and point out that the administration is also...
Right.
It looks different. It feels different. But they're also bullying the Russian government.
Okay. So expand on that. Yeah.
The threat of sanctions right. that have already been imposed. One of the big problems is that the Russian government is just not that sensitive to some of these sanctions. It's not as democratic. It's not as market-oriented an economy. It is a much more capitalistic structure than it used to be. But the people who got exorbitantly rich coming out of the Cold War remain so, and in some cases relatively insulated from competition, and find their abilities to make markets even when the United States tries to shut down certain markets. And counterproductively, we seem to be driving the Russian economy into the arms of the Chinese economy, probably not in our long-term interest. So it's not as though the White House isn't trying to bully the Russians. It just doesn't work very well. The bullying, the economic sanctions are only on the order of magnitude and probably not as great as Putin's interest in taking over Ukraine. I mean, if Putin right. had to pick one straight up, you know, lift the sanctions or give me Ukraine, I think we all know which one he would take, right?
Right.
In other words, they're just not as rough. And the other thing that I think undermines our ability to appreciate Trump's bullying is that he doesn't bully Putin on a personal level. And there are some times when it appears a little bit cringy.
Mm.
So, for example, he took that phone call from Putin the other day while meeting with the Europeans. Probably an okay idea. I don't mean that that's necessarily a bad idea to take that phone call. Takes the phone call and then says to Macron, we are all familiar now with the hot mic moment, where he says, you know, Putin wants to make a deal for me. You know, as a former cop who's interviewed a lot of people, I can tell you that people will tell you the truth, but you got to listen really closely when they're trying to lie to you, right?
Right.
And when you use the preposition for, I think that was a real cringe moment for a lot of Americans hearing that. It made it sound like the administration, possibly the president personally himself, are motivated to look good themselves.
Right.
I don't have a problem with that per se, but you don't want that to rise to the level of, and therefore we're going to compromise something else in order to get any deal at any expense.
Right, right. And, you know, a lot of times, Mike, we start off in our show prep saying we're going to talk about this, but then unfortunately we listen to each other and we go off the rails a little bit. So in listening to your response, I'm kind of glad you addressed some things. One of the things is the appearance of Trump being in the bag for Putin in the specific case of Russia, Ukraine. That's the first thing. And you kind of addressed that, especially the cringe hot mic moment. The second thing, though, you touched on, but I'm wondering if you want to think about it a little bit more, talk more about it. And that is the president's bullying, short-term deal-making, is it worth driving former allies, current allies, into the arms of the Putin-Xi sort of alliance here? Because we heard Modi the other day, and in researching this, I thought it was under the radar, but after Trump kept trying to take credit for brokering that peace deal between India and Pakistan,
Modi got mad
and ran straight, quote, to his very good friend and friend of India, Vladimir Putin.
Yep.
Right? And we know the Chinese are just waiting to grow. They're the number two economy. Yes, we're way ahead of them. But I'm concerned that the vilification of the administration of the Chinese government on the economic front.
Yep.
I think the viewers know our Mike Termott's, Big John's personal disdain for the use of tariffs as a blunt instrument economically. The question I have for you, is the president's pursuit of peace, which again, both of us think is fantastic, give him credit, But is the methodology he's using perhaps not as effective? We've talked about that. But is it also counterproductive in the long run in that it is now forming, in essence, a BRICS alliance again without the South American right now? Although, just to throw this in, supposedly boots on the ground in Venezuela soon, right? Isn't that we heard about troops moving into South America? So are these types of things setting up another, if not hot war, cold war? But this time it'll be Russia, China, India, and Brazil, like the South American countries. Are we in our pursuit of Trumpian peace actually fostering the potential of another Cold War?
I think the potential is absolutely there. I was once taught by a boss of mine, you want to negotiate hard, you don't want to negotiate too hard. And what he meant by that was, don't leave the person with whom, the entity with whom you're negotiating, in a position where the deal just isn't that good for them, and they no longer have an incentive to work with you. They may want to get out of the deal in the future, or they may find ways to make money or make their own success without you. Are you forming a partnership, or are you just gaining short-term compliance? And I think that that's just another way of saying what you've just said. It is not in our interest for BRICS to succeed. That's probably true. But as I have said in the past, I'd like to emphasize today, it is also not in the interest of Brazil, Russia, India, or China for it to succeed either. What I fear is that those nations will isolate themselves from the more important part of the world. They're a very small part of the world. If they isolate themselves from the United States and the West, they will suffer much more than New York and Berlin will suffer. And so you've also got a slight, I don't want to overstate this, but a slight ethical obligation to keep those people from doing something stupid to themselves, right? If you're betting on the Chinese economy, I hope you're not doing it with my money. That's a really, really bad idea. The right. Russians should be trying for something more interesting, which brings me to another conversation with an old boss I had a long time ago, which is, I had to admit, and I have admitted this to more than one employer from time to time, my job is not to come up with good ideas. My job is to come up with ideas.
Right.
Your job is to figure out which ones are any good.
Right, right.
Okay.
Right.
So here's my idea. We should be approaching the Russian government and the Ukrainian government, but we're trying to find an incentive for the Russian government to engage in at least a ceasefire and hopefully into a permanent peace deal, right? That's what we're looking for. And it's hard because Putin wants to reconstitute the Russian Empire. He wants to take over Ukraine. And he believes probably correctly, that given time, he can pull that off at enormous expense. And right. He seems to be willing to, okay. So we're trying to figure out a way to incentivize him not to. It seems to me that we should be going to the Russian government and saying, don't we all just want to get rich? And work on not so much keeping Ukraine out of NATO, which is, you know, a legitimate interest on behalf of Moscow, has been for a long time. We promised them a long time ago because that was something they're interested in. They have a paranoid population, probably for cause, part of the culture. We all understand that. I'm not suggesting they were negotiating in bad faith to keep Ukraine out of NATO. But, okay, instead of keeping Ukraine out of NATO, I would go to Russia and say, here's how we want to bring you into the European Union. Here's how we want to make you wealthy. Meaning, instead of Vladdy, instead of you becoming the guy who looks back and finds a way to reconstitute the Russian Empire, let us make you the guy who looks forward, who marks 2025 as the transformational moment in modern Russia, at the point at which we left behind not only the Stalinist bullying, right, but right. we left behind the communism once and for all, and we learned how to make Russia a major economic power in the future. That's how we make you famous for the rest of the 21st century, not by conquering Lithuania.
Right. Mike, what you're saying has resonance with me. It really is the old, for those of us old enough to have lived through it, the Reagan-esque period where we used to say, what was it that brought
blue
down
jeans.
The
eyes?
Blue jeans, Levi's, rock and roll, right? And literally, it was those three American brands exported to the youth of the Soviet Union that in my opinion, that and the amount of money they were spending on Afghanistan, that brought down the Iron Curtain. Right now, I like what you said, forward-looking. We'll make a lot more money. It appeals to that oligarch nature of what seems to be Russian leadership, right? Almost gangster-like. The problem right. I have with it is, can we do it with a U.S. president who himself is looking back to economic systems of the 17th century to maintain Western hegemony, to say, hey, let's move forward, but don't mind us, we're actually moving backwards economically.
He is a mercantilist. He's not a free trader. I don't think he understands the value that could be in it for Russia, and that makes him the wrong guy to do the sale. Putin is also the wrong guy to whom to make this sale. The oligarchs may be the right, you know, the ones with children and grandchildren are the guys that you want to go after. And they are all guys, pardon my sexism.
Right.
But they are guys. Those are the ones that you want to go after. The dukes and the princes, and have them convince the king, because this king is yeah. I believe, just not hearing it. Which brings us back to the earlier notion of a short-term transaction. If we believe, as I do, that Putin's long-term interest is unlikely to be daunted.
Right.
He wants Ukraine. He wants all of Ukraine. And whatever deal he cuts in 2025, by the way, I think there's a serious chance that he cuts no deal at all in 2025. Right. But if he cuts a deal in 2025, I think it's temporary. I don't know how he violates it. I don't know how he gets around it, but he eventually does. That would be my prediction. So what you're playing for here is potentially only something that's short term. But Putin's not going to last forever. This administration is not going to last forever. As much as we love all of them, none of them are going to last forever. And there is something that Donald said the other day that actually warmed my heart. It is true that I found it very cringy, the hot mic moment when he was speaking to Macron. I thought that was really unfortunate, and maybe we're wrong about, you know, the importance of that statement, but it seemed to indicate right. something that we didn't want to hear. But he did say something that was sort of off the cuff, and struck me as something that maybe he really meant. I don't know about the motivation, but he said, in response to one of the European leaders saying, you know, let's get together, let's talk in a month. And he said, paraphrase, I won't get the quote exactly right, a month, there'll be 30 or 40,000 more killed if we wait a month. I was impressed by that. A lot of people just refuse to hear that Donald Trump has good motivations about anything. So I'm going to ask you to set that aside, right? and just for a moment say, who cares what the motivations are? You know, if this is just all about him feeling good about himself and self-aggrandizement, that's okay if he believes the path to doing that is avoiding 10,000 more deaths a week, right?
I agree with you. And I will look, as much as I am not a Donald Trump fan, as much as my partner William Del Pilar will daily remind me that I am a severe sufferer of TDS, I will try to give President Trump where I think credit is due. And one of it is, I honestly believe he is sincere when he says, I just want the killing to stop.
Yeah,
I believe him because that's one of the few things he has been consistent about his entire life. I think he views war, for whatever reason, whether it's the humanity of it, whether it's the business aspect of it, I'm not sure. But I will say I do believe him. I think he's being sincere when he said, when that quote you just hit, in a month there'll be another 40,000 people who have been killed.
Right.
I buy him. I take that at face value. I think he's being sincere. And to that extent, I give him all the credit in the world.
Yep.
I just question whether the methods he's choosing to achieve his sincere objective are going to get him there. That's, you know, because, like, I mean, we've all said that. Look, as libertarians, we always say, sometimes you got to swallow bitter medicine to get the cure. That there's just no avoiding it. I mean, look, when it comes to spending, you got to make cuts. Some people will be put out right now. We understand that. But in the long run, it's better for everybody involved.
Yep.
So is the president willing to swallow some bitter medicine is my question.
I think the answer might be yes.
Mm.
And what I wonder is whether the rest of the world is willing to swallow the bad medicine that President Trump prescribes in order to get what some of us might view as a short-term and ill-motivated solution.
Right.
If I'm right, then in the long run, we've really got a Putin problem and that it's going to be very difficult to get a deal with Putin. Maybe the objective should be getting any deal at all with Putin. Just slow him down. Hope we can outlast him. Let's get Swedish boots on the ground to make sure that it holds for as long as possible.
Mm.
Will the rest of the world put up with the idea of trading away some Ukrainian ground, Ukrainian land? And we know, let me jump in here because I hear people complaining when I use those words. I know it's more than just land you trade away. I mean, you know, these are people's lives, people's families. And in some cases, let's not go too far down this rabbit hole, but in some cases, there are fates that you create when you give this land away that are worse than death.
Mm.
I understand that. I in no way want to minimize that. It is horrific what we are discussing. War is horrific. Right. What we're discussing as a solution is potentially same order of magnitude horrific. We're just trying to make it affect as few number of people as possible for the killing to stop. And then maybe in the long run, we find a solution that makes more sense, or we find ways to mitigate the damage. If the world were prepared to embrace what I can only imagine Zelensky is not prepared to embrace. I can't even to put myself in his situation. It's almost unimaginable.
Well, I mean, I let's use recent U.S. history. What if the price of peace in 1960 meant we give Florida to the USSR? What if that was the price of peace? Would we have put up with it? Would we have said, sure, let's stop the killing. We'll give up Florida. We'll make Florida part of Cuba because that'll bring peace. If that was the price of peace, would we have paid it? And while I understand what you're saying, and I'm very, very, very much in favor of just having the killing stop, I ask those, even libertarians, who are just like, the hell with what Zelensky wants. Because now we're also hearing running down his authority, right? He's, he, you know, what did I see? Legal president. He is the legal president, you know, in a lot of air quotes by President Trump on his Truth Social posts. So now we're questioning his authority from a governmental perspective, which we know is there. So to the extent that we're asking Zelensky to say, you want peace, you want your people to stop dying, give up, what is it, 25% of your sovereignty to Putin. And we know behaviorally, once you cave in to a bully, they're just coming back for more. They're not going to stop, right?
Right. So,
and I'm not by any means, I'm not saying I have the solution, Mike. But you can see where it's not as cut and dried as stop sending them arms, stop funding them. You know, you hear a lot of correct slogans about the military-industrial complex and things like that. But at the end of the day, if the Ukrainian – forget Zelensky – if the Ukrainian people, to your point, and I see you're very moved by it, if your people say, look, we'd rather die fighting for our ancestral homeland than give it to the Russian bear, what happens in that situation? What is the U.S. prepared to do? Are we going back to the Kissinger type of diplomacy at that point? Just pile up – work as much game theory, Harvard game theory as we can with the Russians again? Are we going back – and that's what I meant by a Cold War, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
Turn into a hot war, right?
It's like, I understand. Kissinger, by the way, still believes Vietnam was a good idea.
Yeah, yeah. He views everything he did as the perfect solution to every problem that ever came up. So
right. We demonstrated to the communist world that we wouldn't put up with their expansionism, right? Slowed them down.
Right.
Without knowing the answer, I think that my argument would be it's not clear to me that by giving away another 10,000 or 100,000 lives, we're going to end up in a better negotiating position.
Agreed. I don't know what the answer is.
That's the real – I think that's the real problem. And so in that sense, I commend the effort of the Trump administration to try to bring it to a close almost by any means necessary and hope that in the long run we get to a better place. If – the Zelensky administration were able to, and believe me, if they are not able to think through this rationally, shame on them, but I completely understand. I don't know that it would be easy for any human being in his situation to think through this completely rationally. But if you were able to do so, are there things that you could negotiate for? Control mechanisms, you know, you give away the land, but can you get security guarantees, not just for the rest of Ukraine, but can you get some sort of security for the people left on the wrong side of the new de facto border? Can you make sure that the mistreatment of those people is not as horrific as we fear? Can we get as many people out as possible in advance of the deal or soon right. after the deal? Can we get an open border, right? Can we get an open border so that we can send people in to monitor the situation, so that people can exodus to the extent to which that they want to? Could you negotiate for the return of the missing children? That is something that I fear deeply that will be virtually impossible, that the Russian government will agree to it and find it very difficult on which to deliver. I worry about that a great deal. If certain organizations' claims are to be believed, that's a very large scale, large magnitude problem.
Right.
Can you negotiate for something there? So there are things that you would ask for if you knew that it were come, if you knew there is no escaping, right? There's no way you're going to get the Donbass back, the four oblasts. Right, the four regions, You're not getting those back. You're not getting the fifth, the Crimea, back. You're not getting those back, the Donbass and the other two in Crimea. You're not getting them back. If you knew that, if you could resolve yourself to that, could you then get into a rational frame of mind where you say, okay, how do I mitigate the human suffering?
That is the question. And to your point, I don't know what the answer is, right? I don't know. Is it like, do you trade the land for NATO invasion? Do you trade the land to get your nukes back? Security guarantees, honestly, if I was Ukraine, would mean nothing to me. We've seen that they've meant nothing in the past. So why would they buy into it now? There's absolutely no reason for them to think anybody's going to come to their aid. So is it letting them get their nukes back? Maybe that's part of the deal. I don't know. Maybe it's...
I think you have to have boots on the ground. If I'm Zelensky, I need foreign boots on the ground.
And that goes counter to the whole point, right? If you're the U.S., you don't want U.S. boots there.
No. Well, if you're the Swedes, you don't want Swedish boots there. If you're the British, you don't want British boots. I get that, right? Yeah. We all get that. Of course. Of course.
Right.
And to your point, there's no other way to trust a security guarantee.
Yeah.
Just no way.
So, Mike, I'm going to put you in the prediction business right now. By the end of the year, are we going to see any sort of holding ceasefire between Russia and Ukraine? I won't even say peace deal. Ceasefire.
I think that we get ceasefires that are by their design temporary. And the only argument there will be is whether that's actually a ceasefire, right? There will be people who support the administration who say, that was a deal, there's a peace deal, there is a ceasefire. But, you know, you, for example, probably won't characterize it as such, and, you know, probably I won't either. That'd be my prediction. I'm hoping that I'm wrong about that, and we get something that shuts down killing for a matter of years.
Right.
I don't mean for 20 years, you know, give me two, give us four, give us enough time that we can make the case for Russia to come into the modern world economy and hopefully change the incentive structure. None of this is going to last unless we can change the incentive structure. 100,000 years ago, I used to teach MBA students at the local university at Nova in South Florida, where I was living. And on their final exam question, when can you trust someone? And it was multiple choice. It was easy, multiple choice, right? And your choices were, you know, when you have a contract. I think A was when they say so. Okay, and B was when you have a contract, and C was based on their past behavior, and D was when it's in their own self-interest.
Right.
Until we change the incentive structure in the minds of the leaders of the Russian Federation, there can be no lasting peace.
And as perhaps sad as that is, I have to let that be the last word. All right. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Mike Termoff, for today's episode. It's thought-provoking, if nothing else, that peace is a lot more difficult to achieve than press releases would have us believe. Until next week, when we have another episode of Liberty Lens here for you, this has been Big John along with Mike Termoff. Peace, everyone.